content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll finish with the article we started last time, titled Into the Heart of India by Joshua Hammer. From flower markets and colonial forts to shrines and battlefields, a river journey in West Bengal reveals the enduring imprint of empire and the soul of a region shaped by centuries of change. After the Mughal emperor granted Clive the Diwani, British tax collectors extorted the Bengali peasantry to raise funds and enrich themselves, precipitating widespread poverty. Clive returned permanently to England in 1767 and won election to Parliament. Meanwhile, in the late 1760s, a devastating drought caused the local rice crop to fail. With grain stores empty after the East India Company's short-sighted managers had stopped maintaining them, a famine took hold in 1769 and in 1770, in which one-third of Bengal's population died. Whistleblowers from the company went public in England with stories of mismanagement and mass death, and a furor erupted in Parliament and the press. "We have murdered, deposed, plundered, usurped," thundered the historian Horace Walpole as the extent of the devastation became clear. Clive in England was publicly mocked. One satire called him Lord Vulture, deaf to every sentiment of justice and humanity, whose avarice knows no bounds. In Parliament, Clive passionately defended himself to general ridicule. "Given the riches available to him to plunder," he proclaimed, "I stand astonished by my own moderation." But on November 22, 1774, Clive, depressed, ailing, and facing withering criticism in the House of Commons, cut his throat with a penknife at his home in London's Berkeley Square. He was 49 years old. Several years ago, British protesters launched a drive to remove Clive's statues at Whitehall in central London and in his birthplace in Shropshire, with one petition decrying what it called an outdated monument. Shropshire's local council rejected a proposal to remove its statue, but it agreed to add a freestanding plaque that addresses the pernicious effects of Clive's rule. In Whitehall, the statue remains standing unadorned. According to Banerjee, Bengal has already gone through its own period of monument purging decades earlier. In the 1960s and early 1970s, when crowds tore down statues of British statesmen and soldiers that had stood in parks and town squares for generations. Many of these relics are stashed inside the early 19th century Governor General's house in Barakapur, a one-time military town just north of Kolkata. But the fervor wound down by the mid-1970s, and protesters didn't target the Clive statue that stands inside Kolkata's Victoria Memorial, a marble structure dedicated to the Queen and erected by the Raj between 1906 and 1921. Kolkata's Clive statue has even become a draw for Indian tourists who are lining up to take photographs alongside it when I visited. Jawar Sikar, a public intellectual and a former member of the Parliament of India representing West Bengal, believes that Bengalis, who lived under British rule longer than any other group in India, developed a peculiar bond with the British. "Kolkata celebrates Christmas as no one else does," he says. "Cricket test matches, great pieces of British architecture, these have been internalized with no rancor." Many Indian scholars acknowledge a mixed legacy of the effects of British rule. Britain's use of systematic violence was no better than that of its rivals. Sunil Kilnani, a historian and political scientist at India's Ashoka University, wrote in The New Yorker in 2022, "The British were simply more skilled at hiding it. At the same time, Kilnani has argued that India owes to Britain a concept of state and the principle, if rather a deformed conduct, of representative politics. Others point to Britain's construction of a nationwide railway, establishment of a judicial system, even if it was originally based against the local population, a unified civil administration, and legal concepts such as individual rights and equality as foundations for modern India. While these inheritances hardly excuse or diminish the negative impacts of British rule, Sarkar told me, they have played a critical role in the country's ability to build a new nation after independence. A train bore us back to Kolkata from the Faraka Barrage, the dam that controls the flow from the Ganges into the Hooghly, completing in 5 hours a distance that had taken us nearly a week to cover on the river. The jolting journey was a shock to the system after the smooth cruising on the Hooghly. Nearing the metropolis, we rumbled past Barakapur, where, in March 1857, Mangal Pandey, a high-caste Hindu sepoy, attacked two East India Company officers, an act that helped inspire what became known as the Indian Mutiny. East India Company overlords hanged Pandey for his crime on April 8, 1857. A month later, tens of thousands of Indian troops revolted against their East India Company masters. The firm prevailed after a year of bloody battles across India, but it was a Pyrrhic victory. Parliament seized control of the company's 200,000-man security force and its administrative powers, ushering in direct rule by the crown. An act of parliament dissolved the firm on June 1, 1874. The colonial period endured for another three quarters of a century, but the spirit of resistance had been aroused. Bengalis now celebrate Pandey as a martyr and a hero, the first in a string of prominent freedom fighters who helped throw off the yoke of British rule. In Kolkata, the former Dalhousie Square, the heart of the British era city, renamed after a Governor General of India, was renamed Binoy Badal Dinesh Bagh Square. It commemorates three young nationalists who, in 1930, disguised as Europeans, entered the Writers' Building, the East India Company's former headquarters, and shot to death a hated British officer. Badal Gupta swallowed cyanide after his capture. Binoy Basu and Dinesh Gupta shot themselves, and the latter survived the injury and was hanged at the age of 19. I was reminded one last time of the scars left by imperial oppression when I pulled up at the airport to leave. The facility was renamed in 1995 to honor Netaji Subhas Chandra Bose, a famed Bengali freedom fighter. In 1941, Bose traveled to Germany, where he met with Adolf Hitler and Heinrich Himmler. The Nazis provided him with 3,000 anti-British guerrillas recruited from Indian POWs captured by German forces in North Africa. After the German collapse, Bose sought an alliance with the Japanese. In the last days of World War II, he tried to escape to Manchuria but died in a plane crash in Japanese-occupied Taiwan. Today, many people regard him as Bengal's greatest hero, his radical anti-British resistance trumping his coziness with the world's most egregious murderers. I don't think there's anybody who has a problem with the fact that Bose went to Hitler for help, Banerjee told me. The enemy of your enemy is your friend. It's as simple as that. Of course, it's hardly unusual for a country to honor its national heroes. One of Kolkata's busiest commercial thoroughfares is named for Mahatma Gandhi, who clashed with Bose over his advocacy of armed struggle against the British. Perhaps more striking is that the city is marked not only by such landmarks, but also by bookstalls overflowing with English language volumes and a major public celebration each year at Christmas. As Mandeep Singh Soin, a celebrated adventurer, a fellow of Britain's Royal Geographic Society and a Delhi-based tour operator, told me, the feeling among many Indians today is that colonialism brought some horrible things, but let's learn from it and move on. It's part of our culture. Next, we'll move on to an article titled Fighting to Serve by Amy Soane. With their bravery during World War I, These daring American women doctors proved their might to the folks back home. In late March 1918, the German army began pursuing the spring offensive in France, its most ambitious advance since the First World War began 4 years earlier. Back in the United States, an enterprising group of suffragists was mounting an ambitious advance of its own. The National American Women's Suffrage Association, NAWSA, was lobbying to get women doctors into the trenches. Though their own government tried to deter them, NAWSA succeeded, sending a pioneering group of 74 doctors and support staff to some of the most dangerous areas of wartime France. The heroic service of this group, known as the Women's Overseas Hospitals, or WOH, would be the most professionally demanding undertaking in the lives of these doctors, who would prove to the world the competency and courage of women physicians. Archives, memoirs, and personal letters passed down to the doctors' descendants reveal a thrilling, politically relevant chapter in women's medical and World War I history that has largely been unknown until now. By the spring of 1918, New York and 11 other states had given the women the right to vote. The House had passed a federal suffrage amendment, and voting rights advocates were lobbying the Senate to do the same. Many members of NAWSA hoped that President Woodrow Wilson would be more likely to support women's rights to vote if they contributed to the war effort in visible, dramatic ways. As Carrie Chapman Catt, the group's president, wrote in a letter to several of the WOH doctors that spring, "We have staked our reputation on the maintenance of a hospital unit which will win laurels for womankind." In 1910, women made up only 6% of all American doctors, many of them practicing in traditionally feminine fields like obstetrics and public health, while facing limited opportunities for faculty appointments. Surgery in battle, on the other hand, was one of the greatest educational value and an opportunity all surgeons must covet. In the words of Mabel Seagrave, a WOH doctor from Seattle, "In April 1917, when the U.S. entered the war, Caroline Finley was 42 and director of obstetrics at the New York Infirmary for Women and Children. The infirmary's Women's Medical College, founded in 1868 by doctors and sisters Elizabeth and Emily Blackwell, had been the first American medical institution run by and for women. Now, in addition to their patriotic feelings, Finley and a group of her colleagues were concerned about the suffering of women and children in war-torn regions of Europe, and particularly about rape, neglected prenatal care, and malnutrition, and they wanted to help firsthand. Seeking an official sponsor, the doctors went to the Red Cross and then to the U.S. Army, both of which promptly rejected them. Secretary of War Newton Baker declared that he did not believe commissioning women would help win the war. With their own country turning its back, the infirmary group applied to the French. At the outset of the war in 1914, the French government had not allowed women physicians to serve in any capacity, including as nurses. By now, though, they were desperate. After a meeting in the fall of 1917 with the French High Commissioner in Washington, Finley received a cable from Premier Alexandre Ribault: "Send Doctoress Finley and her associates at once." The French decree allowed WOH doctors to provide civilian care, but stipulated that those services would only extend to the wounded in the French military upon request if the need arose. In November 1917, days after New York became the first Eastern state to grant women the right to vote, Finley went to Paris to place the first unit. 31 other WOH medical and support staff, including plumbers and chauffeurs, all women, arrived in Bordeaux in February 1918 on the ocean liner Espagne. Docking at 6 in the morning, The group looked as Anna von Schaley of Queens, an infirmary doctor and WOH treasurer, wrote to NALSA headquarters, like a traveling circus. After several delays, one hospital site was destroyed in a bombing raid, and another was deemed too dangerous. About half the group, led by Finley, was indeed called to a military hospital in Oise, north of Paris. Finley's group, known as Unit 1, traveled by truck to Chateau Ognon, a stately home that a week before had been turned into an evacuation hospital, a few miles north of Senlis on the road to Compiègne, the eventual site of the armistice. The group emerged into the courtyard of the beautiful Beaux-Arts Chateau. The salon, where the woman slept, rivaled the splendor of the palace at Versailles, with ceiling cupids and velvet tapestries. Finley marveled at her surroundings in a letter to her mother, rhapsodizing about the old statues with wonderful walks bordered by old trees, and the flowers, violets, narcissi, and little pink and white ones. But there wasn't much time to smell the flowers. In the central portion of the chateau, beneath the stately portraits hung on the walls, mostly empty hospital cots filled the hallways. The only medical staff were two French military doctors and a few nurses. The men initially refused to give orders to the Dames Américaines. Soon, though, they had no choice. Following a major offensive nearby, ambulances rushed in, bringing 300 patients in 20 hours. At first, Finley and the other WOH doctors served as nurses, assisting the men with life-saving amputations, while French priests serving as orderlies held lanterns. When morphine and anesthetics ran out, the French doctors operated on conscious patients. The soldiers, Finley wrote to her mother, have arms and legs hanging by a shred. Many have horrible chest and head wounds. The limited medical supplies included a pot-bellied stove, a pail of water for sterilization, sheets torn into strips to be boiled in the pail, anti-tetanus serum, and bandages. At daybreak, chloroform and ether arrived from Paris, along with further staff, including the male chief surgeon, Dr. Couvalier. The women worked 16-hour days, gaining confidence. By early May, the chateau was home to 500 beds. The women's friendships quickly deepened. The French doctors were not so kind. When Finley asked Couvalier for permission to treat septic shock cases, he said no, but allowed that perhaps the Unit 1 doctors could be given more important work once they've proved themselves. A week after Finley's request, Couvalier got too desperate to be sexist, and he gave her control of an entire septic shock ward. I think to have been given the only thing I have asked for after a week's proof of a kind of work we do is a very good augury for the future, she reported in a letter to NALSA. Soon she was performing major operations, such as amputations and deep dissections, assisted by a French doctor. She had never done an amputation until she went to France, but quickly became an expert. The WOH team found that the work took a toll. The other day I was terribly depressed, Finley wrote in a letter. It was necessary to hurt the men so in dressing their wounds that sometimes I can hardly stand it. One soldier had been groaning and crying. When she finished operating, he patted my arm and said, "Pauvre madame." As debilitating as war surgery could be, Finley took pride in her new skills. Lately, I've been operating a good deal and have had very interesting work, she wrote her mother. I did 8 secondary operations without a doctor to assist me. My arms ached when finished. To the chateau's misfortune, it sat along the course that German warplanes followed on their nightly raids to Paris. The evening of June 17th was calm and clear, but close to daybreak, a German warplane bombed the chateau, leaving a crater in the earth and a trail of carnage. By the time Finley, fellow WOH doctor Mary Lee Edward, and the rest had picked through the debris, they'd tallied 18 orderlies and stretch bearers killed and 12 wounded, all men they had come to know. The house was bombed 2 more times, but perhaps remarkably, no women from Unit 1 died. Among the most prolific healers, according to French military record at the time, the women never seemed to slow for anything. During the final German offensive of the war in July 1918, Chateau Ognon's medical staff performed 3,000 operations in 18 days. On September 3rd, officers from the French government honored Finley, Edward, and von Schally with the prestigious Croix de Guerre. Their one-time adversary, Cuvelier, wrote a commendation that cited their bravery under fire. The women were commissioned as lieutenants in the French army, complete with insignias for their uniforms. There was clear evidence that the WOH was swaying hearts and minds back home, too. The same month that the women received the Croix de Guerre, President Wilson gave a speech to the Senate calling for the passage of suffrage nationwide. "We have made partners of the women in this war. Shall we admit them only to a partnership of suffering and sacrifice and toil, and not to a partnership of privilege and right?" On November 11, 1918, the women celebrated the armistice at Ognon, but their work was nowhere near done. They moved around France treating German prisoners of war and British soldiers alike who had pneumonia and flu, which would go on to kill more than 50 million people worldwide that year, more than three times all the deaths in World War I. In mobile hospitals in various French villages, more than 1,000 refugees and repatriates were arriving each day, with conditions from uterine fibroids to styes. The city of Cambrai was in ruins, houses destroyed and deceased inhabitants still underneath the ruins after months. "We are used to the odor of dead people now," Finley wrote her mother. About a year after the infirmary team returned to the United States, the 19th Amendment became law, enfranchising 27 million women, the largest expansion of voting rights in American history. Returning reluctantly to Manhattan and to civilian life, Finley divided her time between private practice and her role as director at the New York Infirmary for Women and Children, where she made bold moves to reduce obstetric morbidity and mortality. Von Schally became an attending physician at Bellevue Hospital and would serve as a bacteriologist for the New York City Board of Health until 1934, helping improve public health during a significant period for the development of vaccines. Seagrave, the Seattle doctor, became chief of staff of Seattle General Hospital. Though the WOH women had won the right to vote, their fight for equality was hardly over. By the time of Pearl Harbor, two decades later, the Army was still denying commissions to women doctors. It wasn't until April 1943 that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Sparkman-Johnson Act into law, allowing the first woman doctor, an OBGYN named Margaret D. Craighill, to be commissioned into the Army Medical Reserve Corps. Reflecting on her wartime experiences in 1937, von Schally told a reporter that World War I had changed attitudes about women, both in medicine and society overall. "Women seized the opportunities, showed what they could do, and have continued to do it ever since." Next, we'll move on to an article titled Four Fathers by Miles Corwin. Tracing the centuries of innovation that sent the golf ball on a wild ride through history. Historians speculate that the first golfer was likely a shepherd who grew bored with his work one day, swung his crook, and made contact with a rock that went flying. He hit more, and purely by accident, one of the stones disappeared into a hole. Legendary sports writer Herbert Warren Wind mused in 1948. Once a second shepherd appeared to compete, or perhaps as soon as one of them began cursing over a misdirected ball, golf was invented. The earliest man-made golf balls ever uncovered were primitive spheres made of hardwood on the east coast of Scotland in the 14th century. By the early 1600s, players were using balls of cowhide stuffed with goose feathers. When doused with water, the leather shrank and the feathers expanded, and this rough-hewn ball would have flown well for the day, enabling golfers to make truer shots. But the craftsmanship was expensive, creating a sport primarily enjoyed by the well-off. With the advent of golf country clubs that required membership fees during the next century, it officially became a game for the elite. The idea for a greatly improved permutation came in the 1840s. Robert Patterson, a young Scottish divinity student, became transfixed by the possibilities of gutta percha, dried gum of the Malaysian sapodilla tree, which he found as protective filler in a package from Singapore containing a statue of a Hindu god. Patterson heated the sapodilla gum and massaged it until he formed a sphere and later painted it white. The so-called gutty ball was bouncier, easier to control, and much more affordable, making the game more accessible. The inventor of the modern ball was Coburn Haskell, who had an epiphany while strolling through the B.F. Goodrich rubber factory in Akron, Ohio. Spotting piles of elastic, Haskell had the idea of winding up some of the rubber yarn into a golf ball. Haskell eventually added a solid rubber core and a cover. Legendary Bobby Jones, co-founder of the Augusta National Golf Club, as well as the Masters Tournament, described the Haskell ball, first brought to market in 1901, as the most important development in the history of the sport. Jones was displeased, however, that the Haskell ball required less skill and more strength for long shots, and lamented that larger courses were needed to accommodate the greater distances the new ball sailed. Golfers eventually discovered that scuffed golf balls were traveling farther than new ones. Dimples were soon added, between 300 and 500, depending on your taste, after physicists confirmed that air flowed more freely over these balls, minimizing drag, and the increased spin created more lift. And recently, some players have begun sharpening their game by using smart golf balls, with embedded sensors that enable golfers to collect analytics about their shots, identify strengths and weaknesses in their game, and of course, help locate those pesky lost balls. For many enthusiasts, these innovations made the golf game more appealing and even addictive, enabling duffers on public courses to command drives and putts that golfers floundering on the sandy Scottish links more than 600 years ago could never imagine. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.